Your mother's the ambulance, and your dad's the police.
That made her laugh, and she turned to him, arms about him, smiling.
And you're the church, she said. I'm proud of you.
Letting go then, she turned back and waved a hand toward the ghostly door.
Well, if Mama and Da can rebuild from ashes, so can we. Will we rebuild here, or do you want to choose another place? I mean, I don't know whether people would be superstitious about it being destroyed by lightning.
He shrugged, feeling warm from her words.
It's not supposed to strike twice in the same place, is it? What could be safer? Come on, then. Lizzie and her menage will be waiting.
Surely you mean her menagerie, Bree said, kilting up her skirts for the hike to the Beardsley cabin.
Lizzie, Joe, and Kezzy, and... I've forgotten how many children Mama said they have now. So have I, Roger admitted, but we can count them when we get there.
It wasn't until the forest closed behind them and the path rose before them that he thought to ask. She hadn't wanted to look beyond day-to-day survival during the worst of their journey, but he was sure that her vision of the present wasn't limited to washing clothes and shooting turkeys.
What do you think your own job might be, here?
He was following her. She turned her head briefly toward him, and the sun touched her hair with flames.
Oh, me, she said. I think maybe I'm the armorer.
She smiled, but the look in her eyes was serious.
We're going to need one.
Chapter 12. Erstwhile Companions. Mount Josiah Plantation, Royal Colony of Virginia. William smelled smoke. Not half fire or wildfire, just an ashy tang on the wind, tinged with charcoal, grease, and fish. It wasn't coming from the dilapidated house. The chimney had collapsed, taking part of the roof with it, and a big red-tinged creeper shrouded the scatter of stones and shingles. There were poplar saplings growing up through the buckled boards of the small porch, too. The forest had begun its stealthy work of reclamation, but the forest didn't smoke its meat.
Someone was here.
He dismounted and tethered Bart to a sapling, primed his pistol, and made his way toward the house. It could be Indians on a hunt, smoking their game before carrying it back to wherever they'd come from. He'd no quarrel with hunters. But if it was squatters who'd thought to take over the property, they could think again. This was his place. It was Indians, or one at least. A half-naked man squatted in the shade of a huge beech tree, tending a small fire pit covered with damp burlap. William could smell fresh-cut hickory logs, mingled with the thick smell of blood, fresh meat, smoke, and the pungent reek of drying fish. A small rack of split trout stood beside an open fire. His belly rumbled. The Indian, he looked young, though large and very muscular, had his back to William, and was deftly dressing out the carcass of a small hog that lay on a flattened burlap sack beside the fire pit.
"Hello there," William said, raising his voice.
The man looked round, blinking against the smoke and waving it out of his face. He rose slowly, the knife he'd been using still in his hand, but William had spoken pleasantly enough, and the stranger wasn't menacing. He also wasn't a stranger. He stepped out of the tree's shadow. The sunlight hit his hair, and William felt a jolt of astonished recognition.
So did the young man by the look on his face.
Lieutenant, he said, disbelieving.
He looked William quickly up and down, registering the lack of uniform and his big dark eyes fixed on William's face.
Lieutenant? Lord Ellesmere?
I used to be. Mr. Cinnamon, isn't it?
He couldn't help smiling as he spoke the name. The young man's hair was now a little more than an inch long,
but only shaving it off entirely would have disguised either its distinctive deep reddish-brown colour or its exuberant curliness. A French mission orphan, he owed his name to it.
John Cinnamon, yes. Your servant, sir.
The erstwhile scout gave him a presentable half-bow, though the sir was spoken with something of a question.
William Ransom, yours, sir, William said, smiling, and thrust out his hand.
John Cinnamon was a couple of inches shorter than himself, and a couple of inches broader. The scout had grown into himself in the last 2 years and possessed a very solid handshake.
I trust you'll pardon my curiosity, Mr. Cinnamon, but how the devil do you come to be here?
William asked, letting go. He'd last seen John Cinnamon 3 years before in Quebec, where he'd spent much of a long, cold winter hunting and trapping in company with the half-Indian scout, who was near his own age. He wondered briefly if Cinnamon had come in search of him, but that was absurd. He didn't think he'd ever mentioned Mount Josiah to the man, and even if he had, Cinnamon couldn't possibly have expected to find him here. He'd not been here since he was 16.
Ah!
To William's surprise, a slow flush washed Cinnamon's broad cheekbones.
I'm on my way south.
The flush grew deeper. William cocked an eyebrow. While it was true that Virginia was south of Quebec, and that there was a good deal of country southward still, Mount Josiah wasn't on the way to anywhere. No roads led here. He had himself come up river with his horse on a barge to the Breaks, that stretch of falls and turbulent water on the James River, where the land suddenly collapses upon itself, and put a stop to water travel. He'd seen only 3 people as he rode on above the Breaks. All of them headed the other way. Suddenly, though, Cinnamon's wide shoulders relaxed, and the look of weariness was erased by relief.
In fact, I came to see my friend, he said, and nodded toward the house.
William turned quickly to see another Indian picking his way through the raspberry brambles, littering what used to be a small croquet lawn.
Manok, he said,
then shouted, Manok, making the older man look up. The older Indian's face lighted with joy, and a sudden, uncomplicated happiness washed through William's heart, cleansing as spring rain. The Indian was lithe and spare, as he'd always been, his face a little more lined. His hair smelled of wood smoke when William embraced him, and the grey in it was the same soft colour as smoke, but it was still thick and coarse as ever. He could see that easily. He was looking down on it from above. Manok's cheek pressed into his shoulder.
What did you say? He asked, releasing Manok.
I said, my, how you have grown, boy,
Manok said, grinning up at him.
Do you need food?
Manok was his father's friend. Lord John had never called him anything else. The Indian came and went as he pleased, generally without notice, though he was at Mount Josiah more often than not. He wasn't a servant or a hired man, but he did the cooking and washing up when he was there, kept the chickens. Yes, there were still chickens. William could hear them clucking and rustling as they settled in the trees near the ruined house, and helped when there was game to be cleaned and butchered.
Your hog? William asked Cinnamon with a brief jerk of the head toward the covered fire pit.
He'd seen to Bart, then joined the Indians for supper on the crumbling porch, the men enjoying the soft evening air and keeping an eye on the drying fish, in case of marauding raccoons, foxes, or other hungry vermin.
Oui, up there,
Cinnamon said, waving a big hand toward the north.
2 hours' walk. A few pigs in the wood there. Not many.
William nodded.
Do you have a horse?
He asked. It was a small hog, maybe 60 pounds, but heavy to carry for 2 hours, especially as Cinnamon presumably hadn't known how far he'd have to go.
He'd already told William that he'd never visited Mount Josiah before.
Cinnamon nodded, his mouth full, and jerked his chin in the direction of the sheds and the ramshackle tobacco barn. William wondered how long Monoke had been in residence. The place looked as though it had been deserted for years. And yet there were chickens. The clucking and brief squawks of the settling birds reminded him suddenly and sharply of Rachel Hunter, and in the next breath he found the scent of rain, wet chickens, and wet girl.
"The one my brother calls the Great Whore of Babylon. No chicken possesses anything resembling intelligence, but that one is perverse beyond the usual."
"Perverse?"
Evidently, she perceived that he was contemplating the possibilities inherent in this description, and finding them entertaining, for she snorted through her nose and bent to open the blanket chest.
"The creature is sitting 20 feet up in a pine tree in the midst of a rainstorm. Perverse."
She pulled out a linen towel and began to dry her hair with it. The sound of the rain altered suddenly, hail rattling like tossed gravel against the shutters.
"Mm-hmm," said Rachel, with a dark look at the window. "I expect she will be knocked senseless by the hail and devoured by the first passing fox, and serve her right."
She resumed drying her hair.
"No great matter. I shall be pleased never to see any of those chickens again."
The scent of Rachel's wet hair was strong in his memory, and the sight of it, dark and straggling in tails down her back, the wet making her worn shift transparent in spots, with shadows of her soft, pale skin beneath.
"What?
I mean, I beg your pardon."
Monoke had said something to him, and the smell of rain vanished, replaced by hickory smoke, fried cornmeal, and fish. Monoke gave him an amused look, but obligingly repeated himself.
"I said, have you come to stay? Because if so, maybe you want to fix the chimney."
William glanced over his shoulder. The vine-shrouded rubble was just visible past the edge of the porch.
"I don't know," he said, shrugging.
Monoke nodded and went back to his conversation with Cinnamon. The two of them were speaking French. William couldn't make the effort to listen, suddenly overcome by a tiredness that sank to the marrow of his bones.
Would he stay?
Not now, but maybe later when he'd done his work, when he'd found either his cousin Ben or absolute proof of his death. Maybe he'd come back. He didn't know what he'd intended by coming here now. It was just the only place he could go where he could think in peace and wouldn't be obliged to make constant explanations. His stepmother, though he'd always thought of her simply as Mother Isabel, had left the place to him. He wondered suddenly whether she had ever seen it. He'd found more of the Virginia militiamen who'd been at Middlebrook encampment while Ben was a prisoner there. Most of them had never heard of Captain Benjamin Gray, and those few who had knew only that he was dead. Except he wasn't. William clung stubbornly to that conviction. Or if he was, it wasn't from the ague or pox, as reported by the Americans. He was going to find out what had happened to his cousin. Once he had, well, there were other things to be thought about then. He needed to clear his mind, make sense of things, decide what to do. First, of course, Ben. But then he'd need to rise up and take action to make things right.
"Right," he said under his breath. "Hell and death. Nothing could be made right."
Rachel was married now to bloody Ian Murray, a man who was something between a Highlander and a Mohawk, and was also William's bloody cousin, just to rub salt into the wound. That couldn't be fixed.
Jane.
His mind shied away from his last sight of Jane. That couldn't be fixed either, nor erased from his memory. Jane was a small, hard pebble that rattled sometimes in the chambers of his heart.
nor could the thousand-spiked fact of William's true paternity be fixed. Brought face to face with Jamie Fraser, having spent a hellish night with him in the futile hope of rescuing Jane, there was no possible way to deny the truth. He'd been sired by a Jacobite traitor, a Scottish criminal, a goddamned groom, for God's sake. But you've a claim to my help for any venture you deem worthy, the Scot had said. And Fraser had given that help, hadn't he? At once and without question. Not only for Jane, but for her little sister, Frances. William had barely been able to speak when they'd buried Jane. Remembered grief clutched him now, and he bent his head over the half-eaten chunk of fish in his hand. William had just thrust little Frances into Fraser's arms and walked off. And now, for the first time, wondered why he'd done that. Lord John had been there too, attending at the sad tiny funeral. His own father. He could certainly have given Fanny safely into Lord John's keeping. But he hadn't. Hadn't even thought about it.
No. No, I'm not sorry.
The words echoed in his ear, and the touch of a big warm hand cupped his cheek for an instant. An overlooked fishbone caught in his throat, and he choked, coughed, choked again. Monoke looked briefly at him, but William waved a hand, and the Indian returned to his tense Algonquian conversation with John Cinnamon. William got up and went, coughing, round the corner of the house to the well. The water was sweet and cold, and with a little effort he dislodged the bone and drank, then poured water over his head. As he sluiced the dirt from his face, he felt a gradual sense of calm come over him. Not peace, not even resignation, but a realization that if everything couldn't be settled right now, perhaps it didn't need to be. He was 21 now, had come into his majority, but the Ellesmere estate was still administered by factors and lawyers. All those tenants and farms were still someone else's responsibility. Until he returned to England to claim and deal with them. If he did, or what? It was deep twilight now, one of his favourite times of day here. The forest settled with the dying of the light, but the air rose, shedding the burden of the day's heat, passing cool as a spirit through the murmuring leaves, touching his own hot skin with its peace. He would stay here, he thought, wiping a hand over his wet face. For a little while. Not think, not struggle. Just be still for a little while. Perhaps things would begin to sort themselves in his mind. He ambled back to the porch to find both Monoke and Cinnamon looking at him oddly. What? He said, passing a self-conscious hand over the crown of his head.
Have I got burrs stuck in my hair?
Yes, said Monoke, but it doesn't matter.
Our friend has something to say to you, though.
William glanced at Cinnamon in surprise. It was too dark to see if the man was blushing, but he rather thought so, given Cinnamon's hunched shoulders and overall look of belligerent embarrassment.
Go on, Monoke urged, nudging Cinnamon gently. You have to tell him sometime. Now is a good time.
Tell me what? William sat down cross-legged to meet Cinnamon's eyes on a level. The man's lips were pressed thin, but he did meet William's eyes straight on.
What I said, he blurted, before? About why I'm here? I came in case... I thought perhaps... Well, it was the only place I knew to start looking.
Looking for what? William asked, baffled.
For Lord John Grey, Cinnamon said.
And William saw the broad throat move as he swallowed.
For my father.
Monoke didn't hunt much, but was a good fisherman. He'd taught William to make a fish trap, to cast a line.
and even to grabble a catfish by boldly thrusting his hand into holes in the banks of the muddy water where they lived, then yanking the fish out bodily when it clamped onto his hand. An echo of this sensation came back to William now, a brief ripple up his spine, and the sense of turbid water rolling cold and sluggish over his head, fingers tingling at thought of the sudden iron clamp of unseen jaws.
"Your father?" he said carefully.
"Yes," said John Cinnamon. His head was down, eyes focused on the corn fritter he'd been eating. William looked at Manuk, feeling as though someone had hit him behind the ear with a stuffed eel skin. The older Indian nodded. His expression was serious, but he looked happy.
"Indeed," William said politely, though his stomach had congealed into a hard mass beneath his ribs.
"I congratulate you." No one said anything further for several minutes following Cinnamon's bombshell, Cinnamon seeming nearly as shocked by it as William.
"Lord John is a good man," William said, feeling he really ought to add something.
Cinnamon murmured something inarticulate, bobbing his head, and then reached hastily for a small fried trout, which in his agitation he crammed whole into his mouth, thereafter making only chewing noises punctuated by small coughs. Manuk, normally silent, continued to be silent, calmly eating his fried fish and corn fritters with complete disregard for the turmoil in the bosoms of his two companions. William could barely look at Cinnamon, and yet his eyes kept swiveling toward the man in morbid fascination, stealing quick glances before looking sharply away. Cinnamon clearly bore the marks of mixed blood, though he was handsome enough, and that hair could have only come from a European parent. But those tight, exuberant curls bore no resemblance to Lord John's thick blonde thatch. Cinnamon rose suddenly from the cracked porch where they'd perched to eat in the growing dusk.
"Where are you going, mon ami?" said Manuk, surprised.
"To tend the fire," Cinnamon replied, with a jerk of the head toward the smoking pit under the big oak.
The burlap covering it was getting too dry, beginning to char and smoke. The stink reached William an instant later. Cinnamon's mother was half French. He'd told William that before, when they'd spent the winter hunting in Quebec. Did Frenchmen often have curly hair? There was a bucket and a large clay water jug under the tree. William recognized it. It was grey, badly chipped, and painted with two white bands. Lord John had bought it from a river trader when they first came to Mount Josiah. Cinnamon poured water into the palm of his hand, sprinkling it over the burlap, which quit smoking and resumed its quiet steaming, only allowing wisps of smoke from the fire below to seep out under its pegged sides. Cinnamon squatted and thrust several small faggots into the fire under the rack of drying fish beside the fire pit, then rose, his head turning toward the veranda. His face was nearly pale in the gloom. William looked down, crumbling a bit of fritter between his fingers, and felt hot blood rise in his cheeks, as though he'd been caught doing something shameful. The eyes. Perhaps there was something about the shape of the eyes that was reminiscent of Papa. He stopped cold, unable to finish a thought that had the word Papa in conjunction with this. The thought of it was a blow in the pit of the stomach every time. Son. Lord John's son. It was bloody impossible. But there it was, nonetheless. Manuk never lied, nor was he a man to be easily gulled. Neither would he ever do anything that might damage Lord John. William was sure of that. If Manuk said that Cinnamon's story was true, then it was. But there must be some mistake. Manuk's presence, while very welcome, had obliterated William's romantic notion of solitary wandering about the plantation, alone with his thoughts, for days on end. John Cinnamon's revelation had put paid altogether to the notion of retreat.
He could walk as far as he liked. He couldn't escape the reality of the man, big and solid and Indian. And the thought, he's Papa's real son, and I'm not. The fact that William had no blood relationship at all to John Gray had never seemed important to either of them. Until now. Still, if Lord John had had a casual encounter with an Indian woman, or, God help him, an Indian mistress in Quebec, it was no one else's business. Cinnamon said his mother had died when he was an infant. It would have been entirely in keeping with Lord John's sense of honour to see that the boy was cared for. And just what will Papa do when he sees this fruit of his whoremongering loins? That was too much. He stood up and walked away. He'd just wanted a piss and a moment's privacy to settle his mind, but it didn't want to settle, and he kept walking, though darkness was falling. He didn't care where he was going. Turning his back on the fire, he headed toward the fields that lay behind the house. Mount Josiah had boasted only a score of acres in tobacco when he'd known it years before. Was the land even cultivated now? Rather to his surprise, it was. It was too early to harvest the crop, but the sap-thick smell of uncured tobacco lay like incense on the night. The scent soothed him, and he made his way slowly across the field toward the black shape of the tobacco barn. Was it still in use? It was. Called a barn for courtesy's sake, it was little more than a large shed, but the back of it was a large airy space where the stalks were hung for stripping. There were only a few there now, dangling from the rafters, barely visible against the faint starlight that leaked through the wide-set boards. His entrance caused the few dried stack leaves on the broad curing platform at one side to stir and rustle, as though the shed took notice of him. It was an odd fancy, but not disturbing. He nodded to the dark, half-conscious of welcome. He bumped into something that shied away with a hollow sound. An empty barrel. Feeling about, he counted more than a score, waiting. Some old, a few new ones, judging by the smell of new wood that added its tang to the shed's perfume. Someone was working the plantation, and it wasn't Manok. The Indian enjoyed smoking tobacco now and then, but William had never seen him take any part in the raising or harvesting of any crop. Neither did he reek of it. It wasn't possible to touch green tobacco without a black, sticky sort of tar adhering to your hands, and the smell in a ripe tobacco field was enough to make a grown man's head swim. When he had lived here with Lord John, the name caused a twinge, but he ignored it. His father had hired labourers from the adjoining property upriver, a large place called Bobwhite, who could easily tend Mount Josiah's modest crop in addition to Bobwhite's huge output. Perhaps the same arrangement was still in place. The thought that the plantation was still working, even in this ghostly fashion, heartened him a little. He'd thought the place quite abandoned when he saw the ruined house. The thought of the house made him glance back. The flicker of firelight shone through the empty front windows, giving the illusion that somebody still lived there. He sighed and began to walk slowly back. He hadn't found peace, but the effort his mind made to avoid thinking about his paternity, his title, his responsibilities, the goddamn shape of the rest of his life, and now Lord fucking John's bloody fucking son had caused it instead to squirm off in the other direction, latching on to the problem of Ben. Someone had put a stranger with no ears in the grave marked Benjamin Gray. And whoever it was almost certainly knew what had happened to Ben. He'd talked to, at latest count, 23 militiamen who'd been in the Watchung Mountains with Washington during the time when Ben had theoretically died. Four of them had heard of Ben and heard that he was dead, but none of them had seen the body or the grave. And he'd swear that none of them were lying. But Uncle Hal had received a letter telling him of Ben's death. It had been passed to him by an aide to General Clinton,
who had received the letter from some officer on the American side. Who had written that letter?
"Why the bloody hell didn't you ask to see it?" he muttered to himself.
"Because you were too busy being on your high horse about your damned dignity," his mind replied.
That was the logical next thing to do, though. Find out the name of the American officer who wrote the letter, and then find the officer. If he hadn't been shot, been captured, or died of syphilis in the meantime. The next step was logical, too. Uncle Hal would certainly have kept the letter, and Uncle Hal, and Papa, had the sorts of army connections that might allow them to make inquiries about the whereabouts of a specific American officer. He'd have to go to Savannah then, and hope that the British Army was still holding the city, and that his father and Uncle Hal were still with said army. Manoak and Cinnamon were smoking tobacco on the porch when he came back. The smoke mingled with a rising ground mist, a sweet, cool vapour smelling of plants. Evidently they'd been discussing things while he was gone, for Manoak removed his pipe when William sat down.
"Do you know where he is?" he asked directly. "Our Englishman."
"Our Englishman, forsooth," William thought, and glanced at Cinnamon. The Indian's head was bent, absorbed in stuffing his pipe, but William thought he could see a certain stiffening of the big shoulders. "No," William said, but honesty compelled him to add, "the last time I saw him, he was with the army in Savannah. That's in Georgia." Manoak nodded, but with a certain blankness of expression that betokened complete ignorance of what or where Georgia might be. Wherever Manoak's private paths might take him, it evidently wasn't south.
"How far is that?" Cinnamon asked, his voice casual.
"Maybe 400 miles, William hazarded. It had taken him nearly 2 months to make the journey to Virginia, but he hadn't been moving with any real sense of intent. He asked questions about Ben as he went, but in reality he was just drifting uncertainly toward the only place where he'd always felt happy and at home since leaving Hellwater, his home in the Lake District of England. If he said no more, presumably Cinnamon would set off for Georgia, leaving William to what peace he could find here. William wiped his face with his sleeve. The smell of smoked meat, fish, and tobacco hung heavy in his clothes. Mount Josiah would travel with him for some time. He could send a letter with Cinnamon, asking Uncle Hal to make inquiries for the American officer who'd sent the notification of Ben's death. He could do what he'd come to do. Sit and think.
And let Papa meet this fellow without warning?
He was honest enough to admit that his disinclination to allow this had nothing to do with the potential embarrassment to Lord John or inconvenience to Cinnamon, but with a mixture of curiosity and, well, simple jealousy. If Lord John was going to meet his natural son as a grown man, he, William, wanted to be there to witness the meeting.
"The army moves a lot, you know," he said at last,
and Manoak smiled at him. Cinnamon made a soft sound of acknowledgement and bobbed his head, though he kept his eyes fixed on the beaded tobacco pouch on his knee.
"Do you want me to take you to him?" William asked,
his voice a little louder than he'd intended it to be.
"To Lord John?"
Cinnamon lifted his head, startled, and looked at William for a long, inscrutable moment.
"Yes," he said at last, softly,
and then, bending his head again, said more softly still,
"Thank you." "Well, what the devil," William thought, taking the pipe Manoak offered him. "I can think on the way."
Chapter 13. A quote from Marcus Aurelius.
"What is not good for the swarm is not good for the bee."
Fraser's Ridge, North Carolina. The first floor had now been walled in from the outside,
though much of the inside was still just timber studs, which gave the place rather a nice sense of informality as we walked cheerfully through the skeletal walls. My surgery had no coverings for its two large windows, nor did it have a door, but it did have complete walls, as yet unplastered, a long counter with a couple of shelves over it for my bottles and instruments, a high wide table of smooth pine. I had sanded it myself, taking great pains to protect my future patients from splinters in their bottoms, on which to conduct examinations and surgical treatment, and a high stool on which I could sit while administering these. Jamie and Roger had begun the ceiling, but there were for the moment only joists running overhead, with patches of faded brown and grimy grey canvas salvaged from a pile of decrepit military tents found in a warehouse in Cross Creek, providing actual shelter from the elements. Jamie had promised me that the second floor and my ceiling would be laid within the week, but for the moment I had a large bowl, a dented tin chamber pot, and the unlit brazier strategically arranged to catch leaks. It had rained the day before, and I glanced upward to be sure there were no sagging bits holding water in the damp canvas overhead before I took my casebook out of its waxed cloth bag. "What is that?" Fanny asked, catching sight of it. I had put her to work, picking off and collecting the papery skins from a huge basket of onions for steeping to make yellow dye, and she craned her neck to see, keeping her onion-scented fingers carefully away. "This is my casebook," I said, with a sense of satisfaction at its weight. "I write down the names of the people who come to see me with medical difficulties, and describe each one's condition, and then I put down what it was that I did or prescribed for them, and whether it worked or not." She eyed the book with respect and interest.
"Do they always get better?"
"No," I admitted. "I'm afraid they don't always, but very often they do." "I'm a doctor, not an escalator," I quoted, and laughed, before remembering that it wasn't Brianna I was talking to. Fanny merely nodded seriously, evidently filing away this piece of information. I coughed. That was a quote from a, doctor friend of mine named McCoy. I think the general notion is that no matter how skilled a person might be, every skill has its limits, and one is well advised to stick to what one's good at. She nodded again, eyes still fixed in interest on the book.
"Do you think I might read it?" she asked shyly. "Only a page or two," she added hastily.
I hesitated for a moment, but then laid the book on the table, opened it, and paged through to the spot where I had made a note about using gallberry ointment for Lizzie Weems's malaria, as I hadn't any Jesuit bark. Fanny had heard me talk about the situation to Jamie, and Lizzie's recurrent ague was common knowledge on the ridge. "Yes, you may, but only the pages before this marker." I took a slim black crow's feather from the jar of quills and laid it next to the book's spine at Lizzie's page. "Patients are entitled to privacy," I explained. "You oughtn't to read about people that are our neighbours. But these earlier pages are about people I treated in other places, and mostly a long time ago."
"I promise," she said,
her eagerness giving emphasis to her R's, and I smiled. I'd known Fanny for only a few months, but I'd never once known her to lie about anything. "I know," I said. "You..." "Ho there, Mrs. Fraser?" A distant shout from outside interrupted me, and I glanced through the window down at what was becoming a well-marked trail running from the creek to the house. I blinked, then looked again. I knew that tall, thin, shambling figure. "John Quincy," I said, and thrusting the casebook into Fanny's surprised hands, hurried outside to meet him.
"Mr. Myers."
I nearly threw my arms around him, but was abruptly checked by the fact that he was carrying a large, battered straw basket in his arms, and was surrounded, well, quite covered, in fact, by a swarm of bees, these buzzing so loudly that I could barely make out what he was saying. He saw this and courteously leaned down toward me, bringing the bees into uncomfortably close proximity.
"Brought you some bees, missus,"
he shouted over the rumbling thrum of his passengers.
"I see," I hollered back. "How lovely."
Fuzzy striped bodies were bumping and waggling in a brownish carpet over the threadbare homespun of his coat, and streaks and grains of yellow pollen in his beard, this somewhat longer, greyer, and stragglier than when I had first met him on the streets of Wilmington 12 years ago. Bree and Rachel, with Oggie, had heard the noise and come from the kitchen. They were staring at Myers in fascination.
"My daughter,"
I shouted, pointing and standing on tiptoe in hopes of reaching his ear. Myers stood a good 6'7" in his stocking feet and towered even over Brianna.
"And Rachel Murray, young Ian's wife."
"Young Ian's woman."
Myers' smile, always sweet, if half-toothless, widened into a delighted grin.
"And he's young un too, I expect. It's a pleasure, ma'am, a real pleasure."
He reached out a long arm toward Rachel, who went pale at the sight of the heaving mass of bees, but swallowed and edged close enough to take his proffered hand, holding Oggie as far behind her as she could with one hand. I hastily stepped aside and took the baby from her, and she took a long breath.
So did I.
The noise was making my skin twitch, memories of the sounds I'd heard amongst the standing stones burrowing toward the surface.
"I'm pleased to meet thee, friend Myers," Rachel said, raising her voice. "Ian speaks of thee in the warmest terms."
"Much obliged to him for his good opinion, missus."
He shook her hand warmly, then turned to Bree, who anticipated him by reaching for his hand herself, a wary eye on the bees.
"So pleased to meet you, Mr. Myers," she shouted.
"Oh, no need to be ceremonious, ma'am. John Quincy'll do fine."
"John Quincy it is. I'm Brianna Fraser Mackenzie."
She smiled at him, then nodded delicately at his living waistcoat.
"Can we offer your bees some, hospitality, as well as yourself?"
"Got any beer, have you?"
Myers lured his basket, and I saw that it was a stained and ragged bee skep, upside down, with a chunk of dripping honeycomb inside it. This also was crawling with bees, not surprisingly.
"Well, yes," I said, exchanging glances with Bree.
"Of course, do bring them up to the house site. We'll get them settled," I said, watching the swarm warily. They didn't seem hostile at all. I saw several of them lighting on Bree's shoulders and hair. She saw them too and tensed a little, but didn't swat at them. One sailed lazily past Oggie's nose. He followed it in a cross-eyed sort of way and made a grab at it, but luckily only got a handful of my hair. The children had grouped together on the trail above, goggling, but Jem and Mandy had come down to join their mother. Mandy was clinging to Brianna's leg, but Jem was pressing close, fascinated by the swarm.
"Do the bees drink beer?"
he called up at their proprietor.
"That they do, son, that they do,"
Myers replied, beaming down at him out of a cloud of bees.
"Bees is the smartest kind of bug they is."
"So they are," I said, disentangling Oggie's chubby fingers and taking a deep breath of the honeyed air. "Jem, go and find Grandad, will you?" In the end, I found Jamie myself, spotting him coming down through the trees with 4 rabbits he'd snared. "Very timely," I said, standing on tiptoe to kiss him. He smelled of fresh game and damp fir trees. "We've company for dinner, and as it's John Quincy..." His face lighted.
"Myers," he said, handing me the bag of rabbits.
"Did you inquire after his balls?"
"I did not," I said, but he told me anyway. "Apparently everything is still where I put it, and functioning well, he assures me. He's brought us a swarm of bees, among other things."
"Has he? How did he carry them?"
"He wore them," I said with a shrug.
"Oh, aye," he said. "What other things did he bring?"
"Letters.
He says one is for you. Jamie didn't break his stride, but I caught the faint hesitation as he turned his head to look at me.
From whom?
I don't know. He was busy divesting himself of the bees, and Jem couldn't find you, so I came to look for you. I nearly added, perhaps it's from Lord John, because for several years it might have been, and a welcome letter too, reinforcing the bonds or a long friendship between Jamie and John Grey. Fortunately, I bit my lip in time. While the two of them were on speaking terms, just barely, they were no longer friends. And while I would, if pushed, deny absolutely that it was my fault, it was undeniably on my account. I kept my eyes on the trail just in case Jamie might catch a wayward expression on my face and draw uncomfortable conclusions. He wasn't the only person who could read minds, and I'd been looking at his face. I had a very strong impression that when I'd said letter, Lord John's name had leapt to his mind just as it had to mine.
"I'll have a bit of a wash at the creek before I come in, Sassenach," he said, touching my back lightly. "Shall I bring you some cress for the supper?"
"Please," I said, and rose on tiptoe to kiss him. As the house came in sight a moment later, I saw Brianna coming up the slope from the Higgins cabin with several loaves of bread in her arms, and I pushed all thoughts of Jamie and John Grey hastily out of my mind.
"I'll do that, Mama," she said, nodding at the bag of rabbits. "Mr. Myers says the sun is coming down and you should go and bless your new bees before they go to sleep."
"Oh," I said, uncertainly. I kept bees now and then, but the relationship hadn't been in any way ceremonial. "Did he happen to say what sort of blessing the bees might have in mind?" "Not to me," she said cheerfully, taking the blood-stained bag from my hand. "But he probably knows. He says he'll meet you in the garden."
The garden stood like a small, spiky brown fortress inside its deer-proof palisades. The fence wasn't proof against everything, though, and as always, I opened the gate cautiously. Once, I had caught three huge raccoons debauching themselves amidst the remains of my infant corn. On another, the intruder had been a huge eagle sitting atop my water barrel, wings spread to catch the morning sun. When I opened the door suddenly, the eagle had uttered a shriek nearly as loud as mine before launching himself past my head like a panicked cannonball. And a brief, violent shudder went through me as I thought of the beehives in my old garden, knocked over by the flight of a murderer. The scent of honey from the broken combs, mingling with crushed leaves, and the sweet, butcher-thick smell of spilled blood. This time, though, the only foreign body inside the fence was John Quincy Myers, tall and ragged as a scarecrow, and looking quite at home among the red-flowered bean vines and sprouting turnips.
"There you be, Mrs. Fraser," he said, smiling widely at sight of me. "You're welcome in your time, as the good book says."
"It does?" I had some vague notion that the Bible might include some mention of bees. Perhaps John Quincy's blessing came from the Psalms or something. Brianna said that I should come and bless the bees?
"Fine-looking woman, your daughter," Myers said, shaking his head in admiration. "Seen precious few women that size, and none of them at what you call handsome. Oh, pretty lively, though. How did she come to wed a preacher? You wouldn't think a praying man would be able to do right by her. I mean, in the ways of the flesh, as you might."
"The bees," I said somewhat louder. "Do you know what I should be saying to them?"
"Oh, to be sure."
Recalled to the matter at hand, he turned toward the western edge of the garden, where the battered bee skep had been placed on a board atop a rickety stool. To my surprise, he reached into his bulging knapsack and withdrew four shallow pottery bowls made of the soft white glazed porcelain called creamware, which lent a disconcertingly formal note to the occasion.
"For the ants," he said, handing me the bowls. "Now, there's a mort of folk what keep bees," he explained, "the Cherokee do, and the Creek, and Choctaw,
and doubtless some kinds of Indians I don't know the names of, too. But there's the Moravians down to Salem. That's where I got the ant balls and the scap. And they got their own ways, too.
I had a vision of John Quincy Myers, clad in a buzzing blanket of bees, strolling down the streets of Salem, and smiled.
Wait, I said. You surely didn't carry those bees all the way from Salem?
Why, no, he said, looking mildly surprised. Found them in a tree just a mile or so from your house. But when I heard you and Jamie was back in your place, I had it in mind to bring you some bees, so I was a-looking out for them, see?
That was a very kind thought, I assured him with great sincerity.
It was. But a small, disquieting question popped up in the back of my mind. John Quincy was a law unto himself, and if we were being biblical today, one might easily call him a brother to owls. He roamed the mountains, and if anyone knew where he went or why, they hadn't told me. But from what he'd said, he'd been coming to Fraser's Ridge on purpose, knowing that Jamie and I were here. There were the letters he'd brought, to be sure, but the way the backcountry post worked was for letters to be passed from hand to hand, friend or stranger carrying them on, so long as the letter's direction lay in their own path, and handing them to someone else when it diverged. For John Quincy to come here with the specific intent of delivering letters implied that there was something rather special about them. I had no time to worry about the possibility, so Myers was winding up a brief exegesis on Irish and Scottish beekeepers and coming to the point at issue. "I know a few of the blessings folk use for their hives," he said. "Not that I'd call what them Germans say sounds much like my notion of a blessing."
"What do they say?" I asked, intrigued.
His bushy grey eyebrows grew together in the effort of recall.
"Well, it's what you may call abrupt. Let me see now."
He closed his eyes and tilted up his chin.
"Christ, the bee swarm is out here. Now fly, you my animals, come. In the Lord's peace, in God's protection, come home in good health. Sit, sit, bees. The command to you from the Holy Mary. You have no holiday. Don't fly into the woods. Neither should you slip away from me, nor escape from me. Sit completely still. Do God's will." He finished opening his eyes.
He shook his head.
"Don't that beat all? Telling one bee to sit still, let alone a thousand of them at once. Why would bees put up with something unmannerly like that, I ask you?"
"Well, it must work," I said. "Jamie's brought home honey from Salem many times.
Maybe they're German bees.
Do you know a more mannerly blessing?" His lips pursed dubiously, and I caught a glimpse of one or two ragged yellow fangs. Could he still chew meat, I wondered, revising the dinner menu slightly. I could dice the rabbit meat small and stir it into scrambled eggs with chopped onions.
"I suspect I remember most of this'n. Oh God, creator of all critters, you bless the seed and make it profitable."
"Is that right? Profitable?"
"Yes, I reckon that's it. Profitable to our use, by the intercession of... well, there's a parcel of saints or some such in there, but dang if I recall anybody but John the Baptist. Though if anybody should know about honey, you'd think it would be him, wouldn't you? What with the locusts and living in a bearskin. Though why anybody do like that in a hot place like I hear the Holy Land is, I surely couldn't say. Anyway."
His eyes closed again, and he stretched out his hand almost unconsciously toward the beescap, wreathed in a slow-moving cloud of flying bees.
"By the intercession of whoever might want to intercede, will you be mercifully hearing our prayers? Bless and sanctify these here bees by your compassion, that they might..."
"Well," he said, opening his eyes and frowning at me, "it says, abundantly bear fruit.
though any damn fool knows it's honey you want them to be abundant with. Still.
The wrinkled lids closed against the dying sunlight again, and he finished,
"For the beauty and adornment of your holy temple, and for our humble use."
"There's a bit more," he added, dropping his hand and turning to me, "but that's the meat of it. What it comes down to, I say, is you can bless your bees any way as seems fit to you. The only important thing, and you maybe know this already, is that you got to talk to them regular."
"About anything in particular?" I asked warily, flexing my fingers and trying to recall if I'd ever had a conversation with my previous hives. I probably had, but not consciously. I was, like most gardeners, in the habit of muttering to myself among the weeds and vegetables, execrating bugs and rabbits and exhorting the plants. God knew what I might have said to the bees along the way.
"Bees are real sociable," Myers explained, and blew one of them gently off the back of his hand. "And they're curious, which only makes sense, them going back and forth and gathering news with their pollen. So you tell 'em what's happening. If someone's come a-visiting, if a new babe's been born, if anybody new was to settle, or a settler depart, or die. See, if somebody leaves or dies," he explained, brushing a bee off my shoulder, "and you don't tell the bees, they take offence, and the whole lot of them will fly right off."
I could see quite a few similarities between John Quincy Myers and a bee, in terms of gathering news, and smiled at the thought. I wondered if he'd be offended at finding out that someone had kept a juicy piece of gossip from him. But on the whole, I doubted that anyone did. He had a gentleness that invited confidence, and I was sure that he kept many people's secrets.
"Well, then." The sun was coming down fast now. The damp scent of the plants was strong, and rays of light knifed between the palisades, vivid amid the rustling shadows of the garden. "Best get on with it, I suppose." Given the disparate examples offered by John Quincy, I was fairly sure I could roll my own with regard to the blessing. We filled the four dishes with water and put them under the legs of the stool to keep ants from climbing up to the hive, drawn by the scent of honey. A few of these voracious insects were already making their way up the stool's legs, and I brushed them away with a fold of my skirt, my first gesture of protection toward my new bees. John Quincy smiled and nodded at me as I straightened up, and I nodded back, reached out a tentative hand through the veil of bees coming into the hive, and touched the smooth, twisted straw of the skep. It might have been imagination, but I thought I could feel a vibration through my skin, just below the threshold of hearing a strong and certain hum. "O Lord," I said, and wished I knew the name of the patron saint of bees, for surely there must be one. "Please make these bees feel welcome in their new home. Help me to protect and care for them, and may they always find flowers. And quiet rest at the end of each day. Amen."
"That'll do just fine, Mrs. Clare," John Quincy said, and his voice was low and warm as the hum of the bees.
We left, closing and fastening the gate carefully behind us, and made our way down out of the shadow of the towering chimney and along the eastern wall of the house. It was getting dark fast now, and the cooking fire leapt up as we came into the kitchen, shedding light on my waiting family. Home.
"Speaking of news," I said casually to Myers, "you said you brought letters. If one is for Jamie, who are the others for?"
"Why, one for the boy," he said, skillfully skirting the hole Jamie had dug for the new privy. "Mr. Fergus Fraser's boy, Germain, I mean. And t'other for someone called Francis Pocock. You got somebody here by that name?"
Chapter 14. Mon cher petit ami.
I was no longer amazed by the quantity of food required to feed eight people at a time,
But seeing vast steaming mounds of rabbit, quail, trout, ham, beans, succotash, onions, potatoes, and cress vanish within minutes into the bellies of 22 gave me a fresh qualm of apprehension about the coming winter. Granted, it was still summer, and with luck we would have good weather through the autumn. But that was only 3 or 4 months at most. We had almost no livestock, other than the horses, Clarence the mule, and a couple of goats for milk and cheese. Jamie and Bree spent half their time hunting, and we had a good supply of venison and pork hanging in the smoke shed at the moment. But even with hunting, trapping, and fishing by all hands, we'd likely need to trade for meat, oh, and butter, before snowfall. And someone would have to go down to Salem or Cross Creek and bring back oatmeal, lots of oatmeal, rice, beans, parched corn, flour, salt, sugar. Meanwhile, I'd need to plant, pick, dig, and preserve like a mad thing in order to have enough to keep us from scurvy. Turnips, carrots, and potatoes in the root cellar, along with garlic, apples, onions, mushrooms, and grapes hung to dry, tomatoes to be preserved by sun-drying or immersion in oil, if the bloody hornworms didn't get them. Oh, Christ, I couldn't miss a day of the sunflower season. I needed all the seeds I could get, both for oil and for protein, and the medicinal herbs. My mental list was interrupted by Brianna's announcement that supper was ready, and I plumped down at the table next to Jamie, suddenly realizing all at once how hungry I was, how tired I was, and grateful for respite as well as food. The Higginses had all come up for supper in order to hear John Quincy's news, and with Ian, Rachel, Jenny, and the baby, the kitchen was a solid mass of people and talk. Luckily, Rachel's basket was a generous one, and Amy Higgins had provided 2 enormous game pies made of doves and turkey, as well as the bread, and the pervasive scent of food acted like a sedative. Within moments, the only words heard were muffled requests to pass the corn relish, more pie, or the rabbit hash, and the kitchen worked its everyday magic, providing peace and nourishment. Gradually, as people became full, conversation began again, but in a subdued fashion. Finally, John Quincy pushed away his empty tin plate with a deep sigh of repletion and gazed benignly round the table.
"Mrs. Fraser, Mrs. Mackenzie, Mrs. Murray, Mrs. Higgins, y'all done us right well tonight. I ain't et that much at one sitting since last Christmas."
"It was our pleasure," I assured him. "I haven't seen anyone eat that much since last Christmas." I thought I heard a muffled snigger behind me, but I ignored it.
"So long as we've a crust in the house, you'll always eat with us, man," Jamie told him. "And drink, I hope," he added, producing a full bottle of something undoubtedly alcoholic from under his bench. "I wouldn't say no, Mr. Fraser."
John Quincy belched slightly and beamed benevolently at Jamie.
"I can't insult your hospitality now, can I?"
10 adults. I reckoned quickly through the available drinkware and, rising, managed to sort out 4 teacups, 2 horn cups, 3 pewter cups, and 1 wine glass, which I set in proud array on the table in front of Jamie. While I was so occupied, though, John Quincy had opened the ball, so to speak, by producing a handful of letters from somewhere inside his tattered vest. He squinted thoughtfully at them and handed one across the table to Jamie.
"That one's yours," he said, nodding at it, "and this one here's for a Captain Cunningham. Don't know him, but it says Fraser's Ridge on it. He one of your tenants?" "Aye, I'll see he gets it."
Jamie reached across and took both covers.
"Thank you kindly. And this one here is for Miss Frances Pocock."
He waved the remaining letter gently, looking around for its recipient.
"Fanny!" Mandy shouted. "Fanny, you got the letter?"
She was red in the face with excitement, standing on the bench next to Roger, who was clutching her round the middle. Everyone turned, murmuring in curiosity, looking for Fanny. Fanny herself rose slowly off the barrel of salt fish she'd been sitting on in the corner.
She looked about, confused, but Jamie beckoned to her, and she reluctantly came forward.
"Oh, so you're Miss Frances. Why, ain't you a comely lass now?"
John Quincy unfolded himself from the bench, gave her a low, courtly bow, and put the letter in her unresisting hand. Fanny clutched the letter to her bosom with both hands. Her eyes were huge, and had a look on them like those of a panicked horse on the verge of bolting.
"Hasn't anybody ever written you a letter before, Fanny?"
Jem asked, curious.
"Open it, and find out who sent it."
She stared at him for a moment, then her eyes swiveled to me in search of support. I set the butter aside and beckoned her to come put the letter down on the table. She did, very gently, as though it might break. It was no more than a single piece of rough paper, folded in thirds, and sealed with a greyish-yellow blob of what looked like candle wax. Grease from it had spread through the paper, and a few words showed black through the transparent spot. I picked it up as delicately as I could and turned it over. "Yes, it's definitely your letter," I assured her. "Miss Frances Pocock, in care of James Fraser, Fraser's Ridge, Royal Colony of North Carolina."
"Open it, Granny,"
Mandy said, hopping up and down in an effort to see. "No, it's Fanny's letter," I told her. "She gets to open it, and she doesn't have to show it to anybody unless she wants to." Fanny turned to John Quincy, and looking up at him with great seriousness, said,
"Who gave you the letter to bring to me, sir? Did it come from Philadelphia?"
Her face seemed to grow a shade paler as she said this, but Myers shook his head and raised a shoulder.
"It ain't likely from Philadelphia. I can't say for sure where it is from, darling. It was given into my hand in New Bern when I happened to be there last month, but it wasn't the man who wrote it what gave it to me. He were just passing it on, like as folk do."
"Oh."
The tension had left her shoulders, and she breathed more easily.
"I see. Thank you, sir, for bringing it."
She'd at least seen letters before, I thought.
She slid her thumb under the fold without hesitation, though she loosened the seal rather than breaking it, and set it down beside the unfolded letter. She stood close, looking down at it, but I could easily see it over her shoulder. She read it out loud, slowly but clearly, following the words with her finger.
"To Miss Frances Pocock from Mr. William Ransom. Dear Frances, I write to inquire after your health and well-being. I hope you are happy in your present situation and beginning to feel settled. Please give my earnest thanks to Mr. and Mrs. Fraser for their generosity. I am all right, though very much occupied at the moment. I will write again when the opportunity of a messenger offers. Your most humble and obedient servant, William Ransom." "William," she murmured to herself, her finger touching the letters of his name. Her face had changed in an instant. It glowed with a sort of awed happiness. Jamie moved slightly beside me, and I glanced up at him. His eyes were warm with firelight, reflecting Fanny's glow. Fanny fled with her letter, and puzzled, I leaned toward John Quincy.
"Didn't you say that you'd brought a letter for Germain, too?" I asked, under the rising hum of talk.
John Quincy nodded.
"Oh, I did, ma'am. I give it to him already, though. Met him coming back from the privy."
He glanced round the room, then shrugged.
"Reckon he might have wanted to read it in private. Was from his mother, I think."
I exchanged wary looks with Jamie. Fergus had written in the early spring with assurances that all was well with his family. Massali felt as well as a woman 8 months pregnant could reasonably be expected to feel, and he also listed the various objects he was sending north to Cross Creek for us. On both occasions, he'd sent brief but fond wishes to Germain.
I had read one letter to Germain, Jamie the other, and on both occasions Germain had just nodded, stone-faced, and said nothing. Germain didn't appear for dessert. Slices of Amy's bread with apple butter, made by Sarah Chisholm as payment for my attending her younger daughter's childbed, and I began to be seriously worried. He might have chosen to eat or stay the night with a friend he often did, with or without Jemmy, but he was supposed to tell someone when he went visiting, and usually did. Beyond that, I couldn't think of any reason why he would choose to be absent when there was a visitor. Any visitor, let alone a colourful one like John Quincy Myers, whose very appearance promised entertaining stories as well as news. People would be coming by to visit for the next few evenings to hear him. I knew he'd be staying for a bit, but for tonight he was ours alone. Mandy was curled up on Myers's lap at the moment, gazing up at him in wonder, though in her case I thought it was his massive grey-streaked beard that was interesting her, rather than the story he was telling, which had to do with a case of adultery in Cross Creek last month that had resulted in a duel with pistols in the middle of Hay Street, in which the participants had both missed their opponents but had hit, respectively, a public water butt and a horse hitched to a gig, which had, the wound being minor but startling, caused the horse to run away with Mrs. Judge Alderdice, who was sitting in the gig, while her groom fetched a parcel for her. "Was the poor lady hurt?" Bree asked, struggling to keep a straight face.
"Oh, no, ma'am," John Quincy assured her. "Madder than a wet hornet, though, and that's pretty mad. When they stopped the gig and helped her out of it, she stomped right down the street to Lawyer Forbes's rooms and made him write up a lawsuit against the man that winged her horse right that very minute."
The humour in Bree's face changed in an instant at the mention of Neil Forbes, who had kidnapped her and sold her to Stephen Bonnet. But I saw Roger lay his hand over hers and squeeze. She sucked in one cheek for a moment, but then turned to him briefly and nodded, relaxing.
"Didn't she take care of the horse first?"
Jemmy asked, openly disapproving.
"Jim Bob Hooper did," Myers assured him. "That's Mrs. Judge's groom who'd been driving. Bit of salve and a nose bag. Had the poor beast fixed up pert in no more'n a minute."
Jamie and Jemmy nodded as one, satisfied. Talk turned back to the cause of the duel, but I didn't stay to hear it. Fanny had come quietly back and was sitting on the end of the kitchen bench, smiling to herself as she listened to John Quincy talk. I bent to whisper in her ear as I passed,
"Do you know where Germain is?"
She blinked, pulled away from John Quincy's spell, but answered readily,
"Yes'm. I think he's on the roof. He said he didn't want company."
Germain was on the roof, huddled up on the floor in our second-floor bedroom lean-to, his knees raised, arms crossed over them, and head buried in his forearms, a dark lump against the paleness of the bedclothes behind him. The picture of woe, and the picture of someone desperate to be asked what the matter was, in hopes of reassurance. "Well," I reflected, "as Jenny says, what's a granny for, then?" I picked my way carefully round the edge of the floor, clinging to the timber studs for balance, and thanking God that it was neither raining nor blowing up a hurricane. In fact, the night was calm and starlit, full of the half-heard susurrus of pine trees and night-going insects. I eased myself carefully down beside him, hands sweating just a little. "So," I said, "what's the matter, sweetheart?"
"I..."
he started, but stopped, glancing over his shoulder, then moved close to me.
"I have a letter,"
he whispered, putting a hand over his breast.
"Mr. Myers brought it for me. It has my name on it."
That would be startling, I thought. As was the case with Fanny, it was undoubtedly the first personal letter he'd ever received.
"Who is it from?"
I asked, and heard him swallow.
"My ma'am," he said. "It... I know her writing."
"You haven't opened it yet?" I asked. He shook his head,
pressing his hand against his chest as though fearing the letter might fly out by itself.
Germain, I said softly, and rubbed his back, feeling his shoulder blade sharp under the flannel shirt.
Your mother loves you. You don't need to be a...
No, she doesn't,
he burst out, and curled up tight, trying to contain the hurt.
She doesn't. She can't. I killed Henri Christian. She can't even look at me.
I got my arms round him and pulled him to me. He wasn't a tiny boy by any means, but I pressed his head into my shoulder and held him like a baby, rocking a little, making soft, shushing sounds while he cried, big gulping sobs that he couldn't hold back. What could I say to him? I couldn't just tell him he was wrong. Simple contradiction never works with children, even when it's the obvious truth. And in all honesty, this wasn't obvious.
You didn't kill Henri Christian, I said, keeping my voice steady with some effort. I was there, Germain.
I had been there, and I didn't want to go back. Just Henri Christian's name, and it was all there, surrounding us both, the reek of smoke and the boom of exploding barrels of ink and varnish and the roar of flames coming up through the loft. Germain, clinging to a rope, dangling high above the cobblestones, reaching for his little brother. It was no use. I couldn't hold back my own tears, and I held him hard, my face pressed against his hair with its smell of boy and innocence.
It was awful, I whispered. So terrible. But it was an accident, Germain. You tried all you could to save him. You know you did.
Yes, he managed.
But I couldn't. Oh, Granny, I couldn't.
I know, I whispered, over and over, rocking him. I know. And slowly the horror and the grief subsided into sorrow. We sniffled and wept, and I found a handkerchief for him and wiped my own nose on my apron. Give me the letter, Germain, I said, clearing my throat. I sat back against the bed. I don't know what it says, but you have to read it. Some things you just have to go through.
I can't read it,
he said, and gave a small, forlorn laugh.
It's too dark.
I'll go and get a candle from the surgery. I got my feet under me and stood up. I was stiff from crouching on the floor, and it was a moment before I could be sure of my balance. There's water on the table there. You have a drink and lie down on the bed. I'll be right back. I went downstairs in that sort of grim resignation one enters when there's nothing else to be done, and climbed the stairs again, the candle's glow softening the rough boards of the stairwell, shadowing my steps. The truth was that while Massali naturally didn't blame Germain for Henri Christian, he was probably right about her not having been able to look at him without being torn apart by the memory of it. That was why, without much being said about it, we had brought Germain with us to the ridge in hopes that both he and his family would heal more easily with a little distance. Now he probably thought that his mother had written to tell him that she didn't want him back, ever.
Poor things, I whispered, meaning Germain, Henri Christian, and their mother.
I was quite sure, well, almost quite sure, that Massali intended no such thing, but I could feel his fear. He was sitting on the edge of the bed, gripping his knees, and looked up at me with his eyes huge, dark with longing. The letter lay by his side, and I picked it up, sat down beside him, and opened it. I made a gesture, offering it to him, but he shook his head. All right, I said, cleared my throat, and began to read.
Mon cher petit ami.
I paused, both from surprise and because Germain had stiffened.
Oh, he said, in a very small voice. Oh.
Oh, I said myself, suddenly understanding, and my clenched heart relaxed. Mon cher petit ami was what Massali had called him when he was very small, before the girls had been born. It would be all right then.
What does it say, Granny? What does it say?
Germain was pressed up tight against my side, suddenly eager to look.
"Do you want to read it yourself?"
I asked, smiling and offering it to him. He shook his head violently, blonde hair flying.
"You," he said husky, "you, Granny, please."
"Mon cher petit ami,
we have just found a new house, but it will never be home until you are here. Your sisters miss you terribly. They have sent locks of their hair, in case you were wondering what these straggly things are. Or in case you've forgotten what they look like, they say. Joni's hair is the light brown, and Felicity's the dark one. The yellow ones belong to the cat, and Papa longs for you to come and help him. He forbids the girls to go into taverns to deliver the papers and broadsheets, though they want to. You also have two new little brothers who..."
"Two?"
Germain grabbed the page from me and held it as near the candle as he could without setting it on fire.
"Did she say two?"
"Yes." I was nearly as excited as he was to hear it, and bent over the page, shoulder to shoulder with him. "Read the next bit." He straightened up a little, and swallowed, and read on.
"We were all very surprised, as you might think. To be honest, I had been afraid all the time to think about what the new baby might be. Because I wanted to see a child just like Henri Christian, of course, to feel as though we had him back. But I knew that couldn't happen, and at the same time I was afraid that the new little one might be a dwarf, too. Maybe your granny has told you that people who are born like that have a lot of troubles. Henri Christian nearly died several times when he was very small, and Papa told me long ago about some of the dwarf children he had known in Paris, and that most didn't live a long life. But a new baby is always a surprise and a miracle and never what you expect. When you were born, I was so enchanted that I would sit by your cradle and watch you sleep, just letting the candle burn down because I couldn't bear to put it out and let the night hide you from me. We thought at first when the babies were born that perhaps we should name one of them Henri and the other Christian. But the girls wouldn't have it. They both said that Henri Christian was not like anyone else and no one else should have his name. Papa and I agreed that they were right.
Germain was nodding his head as he read.
And so one of your brothers is named Alexandre and the other one Charles Claire.
What? I said incredulous.
Charles Claire? For your granda and granny.
Germain read, and looked up, grinning hugely at me.
Go on, I said, nudging him.
He nodded, and looked back at the page, running his finger along the words to find his place.
So,
he read, and his voice choked suddenly, then steadied.
So, he repeated, please, mon cher fils, come home. I love you, and I need you to be here, so the new house will be home again. With my love, always.
He pressed his lips tight together, and I saw tears well in his eyes, still fixed on the paper.
Maman,
he whispered, and pressed the letter to his chest. It was another hour before the children were put to bed, Germain among them, and I found myself once more in our airy bedroom, this time with Jamie. He stood at the end of the open floor, clad in his shirt, looking out over the night below while I wriggled out of my stays, sighing in relief as the cool night breeze passed through my shift.
"Are your ears ringing, Sassenach?" he said, turning and smiling at me. "It's been some time since I had so much talk in such a small space."
"Mm-hmm."
I came and put my arms round his waist, feeling the weight of the day and the evening slip away.
"It's so quiet up here.
I can hear the crickets in the honeysuckle round the privy." He groaned and rested his chin on top of my head, letting me hold a little of his weight.
"Dinna mention privies. I've nae more than half done with the one for your surgery. And if we've much more company like tonight, I'm going to have to dig another for the house within a month."
"I know you know that Roger would do it if you asked," I remarked. "You just won't let him."
"Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't do it right.
Is there an art to digging privies? I asked this, teasing, because if Jamie was a perfectionist about anything, and in all truth he was a perfectionist about quite a number of things, nearly all having to do with tools or weapons, it was digging a proper privy. Wasn't it Voltaire who said that the perfect is the enemy of the good?
Le mieux est le mortel ennemi du bien, he said. The best is the mortal enemy of the good, and I'm sure Voltaire never dug a privy in his life. What would he ken about it?
He straightened up and stretched, slowly and luxuriously.
God, I want to lie down.
What's stopping you?
I mean to enjoy the anticipation as much as the lying down. Besides, I'm hungry. Have we any food to hand?
If none of the children have found it, yes. I bent and rummaged under the bed, pulling out a basket I'd secreted during the afternoon against just such a contingency. Cheese and a wedge of apple pie, do you? He made a Scottish noise, indicating thanks and deep contentment, and sat down to wade in. Germain's had a letter from Massali, I said. The corn husks in the mattress rustled as I sat down beside him. Did John Quincy tell you?
Germain told me, he said, smiling. When I went out to tell the bairns to come in, he was out by the well telling German Funny about his new wee brothers and his hair standing on end with excitement. He said he couldn't sleep for wanting to see his folk, so I gave him paper and ink to write his mam a letter. Fanny's helping him with the spelling, he added, brushing crumbs off his shirt. Who do you think taught her to write? It's no a skill likely to be of value in a brothel, surely.
Someone has to keep the books, and write occasional genteel blackmail letters, but perhaps that's the madam's job. As for Fanny, she's never said, but I think it must have been her sister. My heart contracted a little at this reminder of Fanny's recent past. She never spoke of it, or of her sister.
Aye,
Jamie said, and a shadow crossed his face at the mention of Jane Pocock. Arrested and sentenced to death for killing a sadistic client who had bought her little sister's maidenhead, she had killed herself the night before she would have been hanged, only hours before William and Jamie reached her. He pressed his lips together briefly and then shook his head.
I will. We must send Germain home as soon as we can, of course. I'm afraid Francis will miss him, though.
I'd bent to scoop up our discarded outer garments, but straightened up at this. Do you think we should send Fanny with him, to stay with Fergus and Massali for a while? She'd be a help with the children. He paused, a slice of cheese in hand, then shook his head.
No. Seven is more than enough mouths for Fergus to feed, and the lass is happy enough here, I think. She's accustomed to us. I wouldn't like her to think we dinna want her, or to feel uprooted, aye? And,
he hesitated, and added in an offhand way, William gave her to me.
He meant me to keep her safe.
And you think he might come here to see her? I added gently.
Aye, he said a little gruffly. I wouldn't have want him to come and not find her here, I mean.
He took a bite of cheese and chewed it slowly, looking away. I patted his arm, then rose and started straightening our discarded clothes, doing the best I could to lay them out in some way that would both prevent them being blown off the roof in case of a high wind, but not end up impossibly crumpled. As I laid Jamie's sporran on top of the pile with my shoes to help weigh things down, I saw the edge of a folded paper peeking out. Oh, Myers said he'd brought you a letter too, I said. Is this it?
It is.
He sounded wary, as though not wanting me to touch it, and I drew back my hand. He set down the piece of cheese he'd been eating, though, and nodded at it.
You can read it, Sassenach, if you like.
Is it disturbing news? I asked, hesitating. After the emotional upheavals of Massali's letter, I didn't want to ruin the peace of the summer night with something that could wait till morning.
Nay, not really. It's from Joshua Greenough. You recall him, from Monmouth.
I do,
I said, feeling momentarily dizzy. I had been stitching a wound in Corporal Greenough's forehead when I'd been shot during the battle, and his appalled face, my needle, and ligature dangling absurdly from his bloody forehead was the last thing I saw as I fell. It wouldn't be stretching things to say that what happened next was the worst physical experience of my life, as I lay on the ground in a spinning world of leaves and sky and overwhelming pain, bleeding to death, and listening to a courier from General Lee trying to get Jamie to abandon me in the mud. I glanced at the letter, but the light was too poor for me to read it, even if I'd had my spectacles to hand. What does he say?
Ah, mostly just where he is and what he's doing, which is none so much at the moment, just sitting about in Philadelphia, though there is a bit about General Arnold in there.
He nodded at the letter.
Joshua says he's married Peggy Shippen. You'll remember her, I expect. And he's being court-martialed for speculating. Arnold, I mean, not Mr. Greenhow.
Speculating in what? I asked, folding the letter.
I remembered Peggy, all right. An 18-year-old girl, beautiful and knowing it, flaunting herself before the 38-year-old general like a trout fly. I can see why he'd marry her.
But why on earth would she want to marry him? Benedict Arnold had considerable charm and animal magnetism, but he also had one leg shorter than the other, and to the best of my knowledge, neither property nor money.
Jamie gave me a patient look. He's the military governor of Philadelphia, for one thing, and her family are Tories. You ken what the Sons of Liberty did to her cousin. Maybe she's thinking she'd rather they didn't come back and burn her father's house over her head.
You have a point. The night breeze was beginning to chill me through my damp shift, and I shivered.
Give me that shawl, will you? As for what Arnold's speculating in, Jamie added, wrapping the shawl around my shoulders, it could be anything. Most of the city will be for sale, should the price be right.
I nodded, looking out at the night which spread its velvet cloak around us, momentarily spangled by a shower of sparks that shot out of the chimney on the other side of the house, fading to black before they touched down.
I can't stop Benedict Arnold, I said quietly. I couldn't stop him even if he was here, right in front of me this minute.
Could I? I turned my head to him, appealing.
No,
he said very softly, and took my hand. His was large and strong, but as cold as my own.
Come, lie with me, Sathnach. I'll warm you, and we'll watch the moon come down.
Some time later, we lay curled together, naked in the cool night, happy in the warmth of each other's body. The moon was coming down in the west, a sliver of silver that let the stars shine bright. The pale canvas rustled and murmured overhead. The scents of fir and oak and cypress surrounded us, and a random firefly, distracted from its business by a passing wind current, landed on the pillow by my head and sat for a moment, its abdomen pulsing with a regular, cool green light.
Echachava acharech,
Jamie said to it. It waved its antenna in an amiable fashion and sailed off, circling down toward the distant flicker of its comrades on the ground. I wish we could keep our bedroom like this, I said wistfully, watching its tail light disappear into the darkness below. It's so lovely, being part of the night.
Nae so much when it rains.
Jamie lifted his chin toward our canvas ceiling.
Dinna fash so. I'll have a solid roof on before snow flies.
I suppose you're right, I said, and laughed. Do you remember our first cabin when it snowed and the roof leaked? You insisted on going up to fix it in the pelting blizzard and stark naked.
Well, and whose fault was that?
He inquired, though without rancour.
You wouldn't have let me go up in my shirt. What choice did I have?
You being you, none at all. I rolled over and kissed him. You taste like apple pie. Is there any left?
No. I'll go down and fetch you a bite, though.
I stopped him with a hand on his arm. No, don't. I'm not really hungry, and I'd rather just stay like this.
Mm-hmm.
He rolled toward me, then scooted down the bed and lifted himself between my thighs. What are you doing? I demanded, as he settled comfortably into position.
I should think that was obvious, Sassenach.
But you've just been eating apple pie.
There wasn't that filling.
That wasn't quite what I meant. His thumbs were thoughtfully stroking the tops of my thighs, and his warm breath was stirring the hairs on my body in a very disturbing way.
If you're afraid of crumbs, Sassenach, dinner fash. I'll pick them off after I've finished. Is it baboons, you said, that do that?
Or was it
fleas they pick?
I don't have fleas, was all I could manage in the way of a witty riposte. But he laughed, settled his shoulders, and set to work.
I like it when you scream, Sassenach,
he murmured a little later, pausing for breath. There are children downstairs, I hissed, fingers buried in his hair.
Well, try to sound like a catamount, then.
A little later, I asked, how far is it from here to Philadelphia? He didn't answer at once, but gently massaged my bottom with one hand. Finally, he said,
ken what Roger Mack said to me once, that to an Englishman 100 miles is a long way. To an American, 100 years is a long time.
I turned my head a little to look at him. His eyes were fixed on the sky and his face was tranquil, but I knew what he was saying. How long, then? I asked quietly, and laid a hand over his heart to feel the reassurance of its slow, strong beating. He smelled of my own musk and his, and a tremor from the last little while echoed up my spine. How long do we have, do you think?
Not long, Sassenach, he said softly. Tonight it's as far away as the moon. Tomorrow it may be in the dooryard.
The hairs on his chest had risen, whether from chilly air or the conversation, and he grasped my hand, kissed it, and sat up.
Have you ever heard of a man called Francis Marion, Sassenach?
I paused in the act of reaching for my shift. He'd spoken very casually, and I glanced briefly at him. He had his back turned, and the scars on it were a mesh of fine silver lines. I might have, I replied, looking critically at the hem of my shift. Slightly grubby, but it would do for one more day. I pulled it over my head and reached for my stockings. Francis Marion. Was he known as the Swamp Fox? I had vague memories of watching a Disney show by that name, and I thought the character's name had been something Marion.
He isn't yet, Jamie said, turning to look over his shoulder at me. What do you know of him?
Very little, and that only from a television show. Though Bree could probably still sing the theme song, that's music that was played at the beginning of each, performance.
The same music each time, you mean?
A brow cocked with interest. Yes. Francis Marion. I recall him being captured by a British redcoat and tied to a tree in one episode, so he probably was a... I stopped dead. Now, I said with that odd qualm of dread and awe that always came when I ran into one of them. First Benedict Arnold and now...
Francis Marion is...
Now, you mean?
Sobrina says. But she didn't remember much about him.
Why are you interested in him particularly?
Ah.
He relaxed, back on firmer ground.
Have you ever heard of a partisan band, Sassenach?
Not unless you mean a political party, and I'm quite sure you don't.
Like Whigs and Tories? No, I don't.
He picked up the jug of wine, poured a cup, and handed it to me. A partisan band is much like a band of mercenaries, say that they mostly dinna work for money. Something like a private militia, but a good deal less orderly in its habits. I'd seen a good many militia companies during the Monmouth campaign, and this made me laugh.
I see. What does a partisan band do, then?
He poured a cup of his own and lifted it to me in brief toast.
Apparently they roam about, troubling loyalists, killing freed slaves, and in general being a burr under the saddle of the British Army.
I blinked. Walt Disney had apparently decided to omit a few things from the 1950s version of The Swamp Fox, and no wonder. Killing freed slaves? Whatever for?
The British are in the habit of freeing slaves who undertake to join the army, so Roger Mack says. Apparently Mr. Marion took, will take, exception to this.
He frowned.
I think he's maybe no doing it yet. I've not heard of any such thing, at least.
I took a mouthful of the wine. It was Muscat wine, cool and sweet, and it went down well on a night full of shadows.
And where is Mr. Swamp Fox doing this? Somewhere in South Carolina. I didn't take notice of the details. I was taken up by the notion, Ken.
Of a partisan band, you mean? I'd been uneasy since I pulled my stockings on and had the absurd thought that perhaps I should take them off again. No running away from this particular conversation, though. The fingers of his right hand moved slowly against his thigh, the soundless drumbeat of his thinking.
Aye, he said at last,
and closed his fingers into a fist.
It's what Benjamin Cleveland, Ken, the great fat over-mountain bugger who tried to threaten me, was proposing to me in a roundabout way, but he was clear enough.
He looked down at me, eyes dark and serious in the dim flicker of the night.
I shall not fight again with the Continental Army, he said. I've had enough of armies, and I didn't think General Washington would have me back for that matter.
He smiled at that, a little ruefully. From what Judah Bixby told me, you resigned your commission pretty thoroughly. I'm sorry I missed it. I smiled too, with no less rue. I'd missed it, because at the moment Jamie had resigned his commission, writing his resignation on the back of the messenger who'd come to summon him to duty, I was lying on the ground at his feet, in the process of bleeding to death. In fact, Judah, one of his young lieutenants who had been present, told me that Jamie had actually written his brief refusal with mud soaked through with my blood.
Aye, he said dryly. I didn't hear what Washington thought about it, but at least he didn't ascend to have me arrested and hanged for desertion.
I imagine he's had a few other things on his mind since then. I hadn't been in any condition to hear or care about the progress of the war for some time after becoming one of the final casualties of the Battle of Monmouth, but it wasn't possible to avoid for long. We'd lived in Savannah when the British invaded and occupied the city. They were still there, so far as I knew. But news, like water, runs downhill and was inclined to puddle in the coastal cities with newspapers, shipping, and the brand new postal service. Hauling it up into the mountains was a slow, difficult process. Am I to deduce that you're actually planning to start a partisan band of your very own? I asked, trying to keep it light.
Oh, he said, in a similar tone, I thought I might. Not so much for the reading and killing mind. It's been a long time since I've rode in a reed, he added, with a distinct note of nostalgia. For protection on the ridge, though. And then, as the war goes on, well, it might happen that a wee gang might be of use here or there.
This last was added in such a casual manner that I sat up straight and gave him a narrow look. A gang? You want to start a gang? He looked surprised at that.
Aye? Had you not heard that word before, Sassenach?
I have, I said, and sipped from the cup of wine in hopes of inducing calm. But I didn't think you would have.
Well, of course I have, he said, lifting a brow at me. It's a Scottish word, no?
It is?
Aye. It's just the men you gang with, Sassenach.
Slange. He took the cup from me, lifted it in brief salute, and drained it. Chapter 15. Witch, old witch. Mandy and I stood on either side of the table, she standing on the bench, looking down into the small yellow ball between us with intense concentration.
How long, Granny?
10 minutes, I replied, and glanced at the silver filigree chiming watch that Jenny had lent me. It's only been 2. You can sit down. It won't happen any faster just because we are watching.
Yes, it will.
She made this pronouncement with a calm confidence that made me smile. Seeing that, she tossed her head and said,
Jimmy says you've got to watch it hard or it gets away.
Realizing that she'd taken her eyes off the bowl, she thrust her head forward and glowered sternly into it, forbidding the yeast to slither over the side and crawl away. I don't think he meant yeast, sweetheart. Probably rabbits. Still, I couldn't bring myself to turn away. I sniffed the air over the bowl, and Mandy did the same with great vigour. I'm sure the yeast is good, I said. It smells yeasty.
Yeasty,
she said, nodding agreement and snorting. If it wasn't still active, still good, I explained, it would smell bad. I'd wait the full 10 minutes so I could show her the foam that active yeast makes when you mix it with warm sugar water. But I was sure in my own mind that the yeast was all right and felt relieved on that account. One could make raised biscuits with soda ash, but it was a good deal more complicated. We'll put some of the yeast in milk, I said, spooning a large dollop from the small crock in which I kept the starter into a clean one, to make more for next time. Jamie's head appeared in the doorway. Will you lend me the wheelas for a minute, Sassanach? Yes, I replied promptly, grabbing Mandy's hand an inch away from the full and open sack of flour on the table. Grandpa needs you to help him, sweetheart.
Okay,
she said affably, and stuffed one of the raisin cookies we'd made earlier into her mouth before I could stop her.
Von Gramp.
I need you to sit on something for a moment. Jamie's long, straight nose twitched at the scent of butter and raisins, and his hands snaked out toward the tray. All right, I said, resigned. One. But eat it in here, for God's sake. If the boys see you with that, they'll be in here like a swarm of locusts.
What locusts?
Mandy, have you got another cookie in your mouth? Mandy's eyes bulged as she made a heroic effort and swallowed most of what was in her mouth. No, she said, spraying crumbs. Jamie finished his own cookie and swallowed, somewhat more neatly. That's good, Sassanach, he said, nodding at the tray. You'll make a decent cook yet. He grinned at me, took Mandy by the hand, and headed for the door. Lacking anything like a cookie jar, could I make one, I wondered. Doubtless Brianna could, once she'd resurrected her kiln. I shoveled the fresh cookies into the smaller kettle and put a large plate on top, then picked up 2 of the big river stones we kept by the hearth to use as bed warmers when the truly cold weather came, and put them on top of the plate. It wouldn't deter the boys, but it would keep insects and maybe marauding raccoons out. The kitchen walls were sound, but there was no glass in most of the windows as yet. I gazed thoughtfully at the kettle for a bit, envisioning the possibilities, and then lugged it down the hall to the surgery, where I shut it up in the cupboard where I kept distilled spirits, bottles of saline solution, and other items unlikely to attract anyone's interest. I heard Jamie and Mandy out on the front porch talking, and went to the front door to see what they were up to. Jamie was on his knees, scraping the wood of what was clearly meant to be a toilet seat, Mandy-sized. Try that, he said, sitting back on his heels. Sit on it, I mean. Mandy giggled, but did.
What's it for, Grandpa?
Ken the wee mouse that got into your room last week.
Yes. You caught it in your hand. Did it bite you, Grandpa?
She asked with sympathy. Nay, Ellen. It ran up my sleeve and jumped out my collar and made off across the landing and into our room and hid under your granny's good shoes. Do you know, remember that? Her small brow furrowed in concentration.
Yes, sir. You screamed.
Aye. Well, now and again we have wee mice and other wee beasties who run to hide in the privy if something's frightened them outside. Now, such things mostly will not hurt you.
He raised a finger at her,
but they might gie a start. And if one does, I dinna want you to lose your hold and fall down through the hole into the privy.
Mandy said, giggling.
Dinna laugh, Jamie said, smiling. Your Uncle William fell into a privy some years ago and wasn't the best pleased about it.
Who's Uncle William?
Your mam's brother. You've no met him yet.
Mandy's small black brows drew together in a frown. He glanced briefly up at me and lifted a shoulder in a half shrug.
No point in not talking about him, he said to me. Likely we'll see him again before too long.
Sure about that, are you? I said dubiously. True, there hadn't been any open acrimony the last time Jamie and William had met in the flesh, but there hadn't been any indication that William had reached a sense of resignation regarding the circumstances of his birth, either.
I am, Jamie said, eyes on the hole he was drilling. He'll come to see about Francis.
I heard a tiny intake of breath behind me and glanced round to see Fanny, who had come down the trail from the garden, a basket full of greenery on her arm. Her lovely face had gone pale and her eyes, quite round, fixed on Jamie.
Will he? You think he'll come?
She said.
Here? To see me?
Her voice rose and cracked a little on the last word. Jamie looked at her for a moment over his shoulder, then nodded.
I'd come back, Francis, he said simply. So will he.
I went back to the kitchen to check the yeast. Sure enough, there was a dirty-looking foam on the surface of the water, and the watch indicated that it had been 11 minutes. Checking the ingredients for the biscuits, though, I discovered that some miscreant had eaten all the butter from the kitchen crock and we had no lard. No one else was in the house. Jamie and Mandy were still chatting on the porch. Time enough for me to nip up to the spring house and fetch enough cream to churn more butter while the biscuit dough was rising. I was making my way slowly along the path from the spring house, carrying two heavy pails of cream-laden milk, when I saw a woman approaching the house. She was tall, with a determined step, and wore a black dress with a broad-brimmed straw hat that she held with one hand to prevent it sailing away on the breeze. Jamie had disappeared, probably to fetch a tool, but Mandy was still on the porch, sitting on her new toilet seat and singing to Esmeralda. She paid no attention to the woman, a more elderly lady than I had thought from her stick-straight posture and easy gait. Closer to, I could see the lines in her face and the grey hair showing at her temples beneath the cap she wore under her hat.
"Where is your father, child?" she demanded, stopping in front of Mandy.
"I don't know,"
Mandy replied.
"This is Esmeralda,"
she said, holding up her doll.
"I wish to speak with your father."
"Okay,"
Mandy replied amiably and resumed singing.
Fair Jacques, so me foo."
"Stop that," the woman said sharply. "Look at me."
"Why?"
"You are a very impertinent child and your father should beat you."
Mandy went very red in the face and scrambled to her feet, standing on her new seat.
"You go away," she said. "I've washed you down the toilet."
She slapped her hand at the air, miming a handle.
"Whoosh!"
"What in the name of perdition do you mean by that, you wicked child?"
The woman's face was growing rather red, too. I had stopped in fascination, but now set down the buckets, feeling that I had better take a hand before things escalated.
"Too late."
"I put you in the toilet and I flush you like poop,"
Mandy shouted, stamping her feet. Quick as a snake, the woman's hand shot out and cracked against Mandy's cheek. There was a split second of shocked silence, and then a number of things happened at once. I lunged toward the porch, tripped over one of the buckets, and fell flat on the path in a deluge of milk. Mandy let out a shriek that could have been heard as far as the wagon road, and Jamie popped out of the front door like the demon king in a pantomime. He grabbed Mandy up in one arm, leapt off the porch, and was nose to nose with the woman before I'd even got to my knees.
"Leave my house," he said,
in the sort of calm voice that made it clear the only other option was instant death. To her credit, the lady wasn't backing down. She snatched off her broad black hat, the better to glare at him.
The girl spoke rudely to me, sir, and I will not have it. Evidently, no one has sought to discipline her properly. No wonder.
Her gaze raked him scornfully up and down. Mandy had stopped shrieking, but was sobbing, her face buried in Jamie's shirt front.
Well, speaking of rudeness, I said mildly, wringing out my wet apron, I don't believe we have the honour of your acquaintance, do we?
I wiped a hand on the side of my skirt and extended it. I'm Claire Fraser.
Her face didn't lose its expression of outrage, but it froze. She didn't say a word, but backed away from me one step at a time.
Jamie hadn't moved, other than to pat Mandy comfortingly. His face was as fixed and stark as hers.
She reached the edge of the path, stopped dead, and lifted her chin toward Jamie. You are all, she said evenly, sweeping her hat in an arc that encompassed me, Jamie, Mandy, and the house, undoubtedly going to hell.
With which pronouncement, she tossed a small package onto the porch, turned her back upon us, and sailed away like a bird of ill omen.
Who the devil was that?
Jamie asked.
The wicked witch,
Mandy answered promptly. Her face was still red and her lower lip pushed out as far as it would go.
I hate her.
Quite possibly, I said.
I bent and gingerly picked up the small package. It was wrapped in oiled silk, tied with an odd-looking cord with a number of extraneous knots. I lifted it to my nose and sniffed cautiously. Even through the murky scent of the oiled silk, the bitter smell of quinine was strong enough that I could taste it at the back of my mouth.
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, I said, looking at Jamie in wonder. She's brought me Jesuit bark.
Well, I did tell you, Sassenach, that if you mentioned your need of it to Roger Mac and Brina, likely you'd get some. And in that case, he said slowly, looking at the direction in which our visitor had disappeared, I think perhaps young woman is maybe Mrs. Cunningham.
Chapter 16. Hound of Heaven. 2 weeks later. I was somewhere deeper than dreams, and came to the surface like a fish hauled out of water, thrashing and flapping.
What?
I couldn't remember where I was, who I was, or how to speak. Then the noise that had roused me came again, and every hair on my body stood on end.
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ!
Words and sense came back in a rush, and I flung out both hands, groping for some physical anchor. Sheets! Mattress! Bed! I was in bed. But no Jamie. Empty space beside me. I blinked like an owl, turning my head in search of him. He was standing naked at the glassless window, bathed in moonlight. His fists were clenched and every muscle visible under his skin. Jamie? He didn't turn or seem to hear, either my voice or the thump and agitation of other people in the house, also roused by the howling outside. I could hear Mandy starting to wail in fear and her parents' voice running into each other in the rush to comfort her. I got out of bed and came up cautiously beside Jamie. Though what I really wanted to do was dive under the covers and pull the pillow over my head. That noise! I peered past his shoulder, but bright as the moonlight was, it showed nothing in the clearing before the house that shouldn't be there. Coming from the wood, maybe,